friends, and welcome to another episode of the End of Sport podcast. Today, it's just me, Nathan Coleman-Lamb, and I am here to share with you a conference presentation that I delivered at the Canadian Sociological Association Conference at Toronto at the Congress of the Social Sciences and Humanity. And there are a couple reasons I want to share this with you. One of them is that this presentation is a bit of an absurd project. It is the attempted distillation of the 147,000 words Derek and I have been putting together in our manuscript for The End of College Football, Exploitation and Harm in the Academy and on the Gridiron, which we have just delivered in manuscript form to our publisher. And it is really the principal reason why we have not been able to record much of late. Hopefully we will be able to get back to it a little bit more this summer, but our attentions have been kind of occupied with that. And I thought it would be nice to be able to share with you a little taste of that project. So it's 147,000 words distilled down to about 15 minutes. So it's just a little taste. And obviously in the year plus to come, we're going to be sharing much more of that project with you in various ways, but this is maybe a first taste. The other reason I want to share with you is just quite frankly because of my irritation at the conference experience, something that I feel so often. But at a conference like this, which has attracted people from all over Canada, you know, there are, I think, something like 11,000 delegates at the Congress of the Social Sciences and Humanities in general, and there were 1,100 at just the CSA, the Canadian Sociological Association. And yet, my actual session, the session where I delivered this paper, was one of only two sessions on the sociology of sport of the at least dozen, probably hundreds of sessions organized by the CSA. And one of the other one was on the critical criminology of sport. So we had one on the critical criminology of sport, and one on the sociology of sport. And these sessions were scheduled in a tiny seminar room, which was not commensurate to the other spaces in which conference panels were being held for the CSA. And moreover, our session, the second of the two sessions, was held concurrent with the two keynotes organized by the CSA for that day in the English language, one of which was on the sociology of health, led by a very distinguished professor from Harvard University. So you can imagine that our session was not well attended. In fact, only five other folks came, five wonderful folks who frankly gave us a really lovely conversation. We basically had almost like a seminar conversation that emerged from the presentations, and it was thought-provoking and satisfying in every way one would hope for in an academic context. So this is in no way to malign those five folks who arrived, because they really contributed to the best of the conference experience. But what is frustrating for anyone is, you know, you travel a long way, you fly, you pay $500 worth of registration fees because you're hoping to engage in the knowledge transfer that the Academy demands of us. You're trying to share the findings of your research to have an impact with it. And so to do so in front of such a sparsely attended room is really frustrating. And that's why I want to share with you today the findings that I shared with those five folks and my other panelists, in the hopes that you can get something out of the research that Derek and I have been conducting into the experiences of former college football players. So I hope you enjoy. Hi, friend. I am excited to share with you today some of the findings from the very major research project that I am co-leading with my collaborator and friend, Derek Silva, into how we have come to understand the experiences of former college football players. In our project, Derek and I attempt to theorize and explore through qualitative interviews how racial capitalism manifests in the profoundly exploitative and fundamentally coercive dynamics of U.S. college football. To date, we have conducted 24 semi-structured interviews with former U.S. college football players. The interviews are ongoing, and have been conducted since 2019 via Zoom and in person. These interviews have ranged from 45 minutes to over 3 hours. Before I get into those findings, though, I want to take just a quick moment to acknowledge that many of you here may be unfamiliar with the vagaries of U.S. college football. When we talk about this sport, what we're talking about is a multi-billion dollar industry with most of its revenue concentrated in the Power Five. Five conferences comprising some 69 mostly public universities. Most, but not all, players who participate in Power Five college football are putatively compensated in the form of scholarships covering tuition, room, and board. Coaches and athletic department administrators, on the contrary, often earn multi-million dollar salaries. Thus, U.S. college football, we argue, is defined by nothing so much as the systematic exploitation of a group of predominantly racialized subjects at the hands of disproportionately white figures of authority, from coaches to athletic directors to university presidents and chancellors. Scholars like Stanley Eitzen and Billy Hawkins have argued that the college sports system operates as a new plantation through which predominantly white institutions, which is to say PWIs, they'll refer to it in the future, predominantly white institutions subject Black campus athletic workers to a dynamic, per Hawkins, akin to, quote, the broader historical and social context of exploitation endured by internally colonized people in the system of slavery. Building on this framework, our project illuminates some of the ways in which college football's exploitative and harmful dynamics are inextricably linked to racial capitalism in the United States more broadly, given that differential access to life chances based on classed racial dynamics and the social and historical racial transfer of wealth have produced the conditions for the new plantation of college football today. Our work also takes as one of its launching points the recent theoretical intervention of Aaron Hatton, who characterizes labor in college sport as status coercion. Hatton argues in the context of college sport and elsewhere that status coercion operates when, quote, supervisors have the power to discharge workers from a particular status and thereby deprive them of the rights, privileges, and future opportunities that such status confers. We agree that status coercion is an important advancement in the understanding of the coercive dynamics that play out on college football fields. Yet we also hold that the coercion of the employment dynamic in college football is itself located within and contingent upon a broader set of political, economic, and racial, that is, racist, relations. Turning to the work of Jill Fisher on informed consent in medical research, we offer the formulation structural coercion because it captures the ways in which status coercion relies on a broader system of racial capitalism that produces the necessary conditions of privation, immiseration, and discrimination that render individual subjects vulnerable to the status coercion of college football. Indeed, we hold that status coercion is itself contingent upon structural coercion. It relies on a subject already constrained by forms of material violence that foreclose a range of agential choices. The structural context of U.S. racial capitalism furnishes a steady and significantly racialized labor supply for college football, which can come to appear for participants as the best of a series of bad options. As one player told us, articulating how he reconciled his fear of long-term harm, it's in the back of your mind, but at the same time, it's just like, we're doing this sport for our family. This is our only way to attain a collegiate education. Because a lot of people that look like me, this is our only way to attain a higher education and get a degree without our parents having to pay for them. Because we don't come from a financially stable situation where they're able to pay for our collegiate education. So you're doing it for so many reasons where it's just like, let me make these sacrifices for my family. However, as Aaron Hatton suggests, college football is also defined by status coercion, the power of coaches to determine access to the limited resources available, scholarships, and playing time. The fundamental inaccessibility of higher education and the dream that participation in football might lead to socioeconomic mobility in the context of a punishing system of racial capitalism effectively compels players to submit to the discipline and control of coaches. One player, speaking of his first June with the team, told us, "One of the very first things that they did, and I'll never forget that, they got us all up in a line, all the freshmen, and they said, 'Look to the man to the left of you. Look to a man to the right of you. By the time you leave here, both of them will be gone.' And the reality of the situation is, that was actually an understatement. All of us will be gone. The amount of people in my recruiting class by the fourth year was in single digits. Very little people stuck around for long, and that's a feat that speaks to the dynamics of replaceable machine parts in a cogwheel that is college football." Indeed, players were under no illusion that they had choice in the world of college football, whether we're talking about the decision of which class to take, if they had the right to determine whether they would consent to participate in university-sponsored research, or whether to attend so-called voluntary practices. One told us, "All of summer workouts are technically voluntary, but you must be there, and guys will get punished in direct and indirect ways for missing. We mixed voluntary and mandatory, like voluntary, whenever we were told to do something. If guys missed summer workouts, they would do like 30 minutes to a half hour on the Stairmaster with like a stick on there, like Christ with the cross." Punishment like this is a pervasive feature of the sport, used by coaches to assert control over players. Control that ultimately allows them to maximally instrumentalize the athlete's body according to the imperative of extracting as much performance, which is to say value, as possible. Take the experience of Evan, who detailed a harrowing story of harm at the hands of a strength coach. He talked about a weekly punishment for players when they did something wrong. They had to go to a driveway with ridges filled with little rocks and do push-ups to the cadence of the strength coach. He told us, "We were out there for probably like 30 to 40 minutes with our knuckles in the ground. And mind you, I was like 350 pounds. So 350 pounds into your knuckles on the concrete with jagged rock. It doesn't take a genius to see your knuckles will be bleeding. My knuckles will be bleeding like crazy. It took about 6 or 8 months for my knuckles to turn back like my regular skin color. Like they're completely scarred. They were pretty much black. Ask any player on the team that one. Everybody's knuckles will be just completely black, no matter what skin color they were." Such dehumanizing treatment caused Evan to develop a serious addiction to painkillers and alcohol, and even led him to contemplate suicide. In this context, we further contend that the PWI institutions of the Power Five continue to function as what Victor Ray has theorized as racialized organizations, and Billy Hawkins has called neocolonial plantation dynamic. It has been very well documented that a significantly disproportionate number of college football players are black, including 55% of players at Power Five schools. Ted Tatos and Hal Singer have calculated that black men's football and basketball players are losing out annually in a $1.2 to $1.4 billion racial transfer of wealth, which testifies to, per Charisse Burden-Stelly, their indispensability to the system. Yet, at the same time, these players also experience what Burden-Stelly calls disposability, for they are all too often subjected to the hostile perception they do not properly belong on campus. Players we spoke with revealed that even as they physically sacrifice to produce the social reproductive labor that sells tickets and merchandise, and indeed literally contributes to the survival of the entire cable television industry, and certainly the sports media complex, they were both denied appropriate compensation for their work and treated as if they were interlopers undeserving of access to the ivory tower. As one player we interviewed said in linking the labor conditions of college football at a PWI to the plantation, "College football was more so enslavement at that point in time. You had no life to yourself. You had no summer. You had no time off to enjoy any part. It's pretty much some type of slavery. You're just doing something to get a piece of paper. You just do whatever your coaches tell you, your academic advisor, your teacher. Another player pointed to the economic dimensions of race in college sport through the access to resources once careers end. The boosters will give white players jobs way quicker than black players. Black players, they'll watch them on Saturday, but they don't want to give you a job on Sunday. There are tangible physical and emotional consequences to the coercive dynamics of the social reproductive labor of college football. Our exploitation in the sport is not simply a function of how value is distributed via a racial transfer of wealth, but also of how the system distributes harm. The physical toll it takes on all who participate. The damage to bodies and specifically minds is compounded by a lack of occupational health and safety provisions, long-term health insurance, and abusive overtraining practices imposed by coaches. One former player said, "During this fall camp, 6 or 7 offensive linemen received concussion. These were the guys that went out and did scout team, and we were running thin on offensive line. And our coach, maybe not directly, told these players, you need to get back here. But I had heard from these players that, hey, they're trying to rush us back. I knew the movie Concussion had just come out, and I knew it was a serious issue, particularly for offensive and defensive linemen. And so I go up to these players, and in our little team meeting, I go, hey, I hear y'all are getting pressure to come back. I want everybody to come over to my house, and we're going to watch this movie Concussion. We're going to watch what happens when you rush back. We're going to watch where this might lead if you're not careful. I knew a lot of players hadn't watched it because they're fearful and they don't want to know this was the dark side of football. But my head coach at the time caught wind that I wanted to get all my offensive linemen together to go watch it. He goes, you're not going to do that. You're not going to get everybody in there and you're not going to watch that movie. And from that moment on, I knew. Safety isn't necessarily the greatest priority. This obfuscatory behavior from coaches is part and parcel of a system that generally compels players to play through injury. Another player told us, as the season progressed, I had a torn labrum over my left shoulder. So my shoulder would dislocate pretty much like every game. It would slide out of place. We just did a shoulder brace and I never took painkillers, like Toradol before games, until the very last game before the bowl game. I was pulled from our last regular season game because like it just came out, was in pain, and I couldn't take on blocks. All of our best players were lined up before the game with their pants down to get a Toradol shot. And it was at this school which had a tiny old locker room. So this is typically done in a doctor's office, but like it was just done right there in the locker room. And I saw it. And I asked the player, like, is a doctor giving these guys steroids? And he said, no, it's Toradol. This painkiller lets you play. So I took Toradol for our season final and the bowl game, and it allowed me to play really well both those games with a torn labrum. So that was eye-opening. One reason players can be pushed to play through injury is the power dynamic that exists between coaches and the medical staff. A player explained, we had a new head athletic trainer, and the coach felt he wasn't getting players back on the field fast enough. And I think the trainer was a decent guy and luckily stood up for players. And they had a weekly meeting like, is so-and-so going to be available for practice? Are they going to be available for the game? And the trainer would, to a certain degree, stand up for players and say, he's hurt. He can't play. And the trainer was demoted to women's softball and helped out with track. And the next guy did what the coaches wanted him to do. So yeah, I mean, the coaches ultimately make health decisions. So, given all this harm, the question we are left with is, what is to be done? Derek and I heretically argue that college football is ethically unsustainable because it is simply not possible to reconcile the pedagogical mission of universities with the inherent harm caused by the sport itself and its inextricable imbrication in a radically stratified system of U.S. racial capitalism. Instead, building on the work of social theorist Olufemi Taiwo, we argue for the abolition of college football in conjunction with a system of reparation, both to current and former participants, but also to those already enrolled in youth football who aspire to access higher education through the sport, given that U.S. higher education and its attendant sport media complex are fundamentally complicit in the enterprise of football at every level. But as Taiwo shows us, the most productive approaches to reparations are constructivist as well as compensatory. We need to imagine sport as a site of play, aesthetics, and pleasure. And that, in turn, requires imagining a society beyond racial capitalism, wherein participation is predicated upon enthusiastic consent. In that sense, justly abolishing college football requires radical and material forms of structural decolonization, anti-racism, and anti-capitalism more broadly. I want to conclude today, then, with the words of one of the players we interviewed, who summarizes this argument. When we asked him, "Would you play college football if you had access to a free college education?" he responded, "Fuck no, man. Fuck no. Nobody would." Thank you.